Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, and welcome to The Parenthood. For many of us, thinking about becoming a parent marks a dramatic shift in our lives. We've often spent the last one or two decades desperately trying not to get pregnant, and suddenly it all changes and we're trying to do the opposite. For many couples, their pregnancy comes as a surprise. For some, it comes without much thought. But for more than we're probably aware, making a baby takes longer and is more difficult than we think. So today I've got with me Dr. Kiara Hunt to talk frankly about conception, how to make sure, if you're trying, that you're actually doing what you can, what you should be doing to succeed. But then also, if you do need help, what you can do to assist the process. So Kiara, let's start with the basics. What exactly is infertility, and when is it classified as sort of infertility?
So I think infertility is basically not getting pregnant, having been trying for 2 years, and that's the nice definition of it. But that doesn't mean you don't get help until you've been trying for 2 years. Usually you'll start speaking to your doctor and getting some tests done before that. And if you look, you know, pregnancy for most people doesn't happen that quickly. If you have 100 couples who are under 40 trying to conceive, about 80 or 90 of them will conceive in the first year. So 10 or 20% won't. And of those that don't, half of them will conceive in the second year without any problems or any help. And the rest of them will need a bit of help
Because you know, sometimes this, because we've been, you know, trying not to get pregnant, you think you don't use a condom once and you are absolutely pregnant. It doesn't really happen like that,
does it? Yeah, and of course you hear the stories of that happening, but that is extremely rare, especially the older we get, of course.
So what, it depends on age though too, because obviously as you get older, you do become less fertile, and how much less fertile you become, you don't really know. I mean, it's quite difficult to know. One 38-year-old will be very fertile and another 34-year-old will not be that fertile.
Yeah, or even quite a lot younger than that. And that's because your ovarian reserve doesn't gradually peter off. It tends to sort of fall off a cliff at a certain age, and when that age is anyone's guess, but it's usually about, you know, gets worse from 36, possibly earlier than that.
So does that mean that if you have been trying for a, you know, let's say 6 months, but you are approaching 40, does that mean you should look for help sooner?
Yeah, so the general guideline is try for a year and make sure you're doing everything that you should be doing to be trying, which we'll talk about, and then seek help and have some tests. Now, if you're older than 36, then yes, you want to be seeking help and having those tests earlier than that 1 year point.
So infertility, in terms of, you know, what causes it, what are the sort of most common, I mean, obviously there's a whole myriad of issues, but what are the sort of main causes of failure to conceive?
So you have to look at the woman and at the man, because obviously both both have to play a role here. So if you're looking at causes of female infertility, you're looking at problems in the ovaries, problems in the tubes, or problems in the uterus. The most common cause is ovarian dysfunction. So the ovaries not releasing eggs every month, or the egg quality or quantity not being good enough. But there can be also disease pathology in the ovaries, so like polycystic ovaries and things like that. There can be scarring of the tubes. So obviously the eggs are made in the ovaries. They have to travel down the tubes into the uterus to be fertilized. And if their tubes are scarred from having surgery before, or having infections in the pelvis from sexually transmitted infections, that can be a problem and can prevent conception. Or problems in the uterus. So are there problems with the lining of the uterus? Do you have endometriosis or fibroids or things in the uterus that can impact whether or not an embryo implants or even fertilizes in the first place? And then obviously with the man, it can be problems with the motility of the sperm, so the speed the sperm travels, the structure of each individual sperm itself, and it can be to do with the anatomy of the man, as to is the sperm actually getting to the right place before it even comes out.
So in terms of, you know, if we've got a couple sitting here listening to this thinking, trying to get pregnant, what is the most important thing to be doing? Obviously, having sex.
Yeah. But you laugh about that. And actually, it's amazing how a lot of couples trying to conceive are not having enough sex. And, you know, the advice is you need to be having sex every 2 to 3 days throughout the month. And yes, you can sort of target the ovulation window, but in terms of sort of stress levels and looking at all the studies that they've done into natural conception, if you're having sex every 2 to 3 days, you're most likely to conceive. You don't want to sort of be storing. Don't think you need to sort of store it up and then it's more likely to be successful. It's much better if it's regular. So that's probably the most important thing. And then I'd say one of the next most important things is stress levels, stress and anxiety levels. And of course, as soon as you're not able to conceive when you've been trying and expecting and hoping to for such a long time, can cause heightened anxiety and a lot of stress. And we know that stress itself affects your hormones, affects the way potentially that you ovulate, affects your ability to carry an embryo in the early days. So stress is a huge factor. And then of course, looking after yourself. So making sure your weight is healthy, and that's not just being overweight, but being underweight. You know, if your body mass index, i.e., you know, your height against your weight, is out of the what's known as healthy range, your body is going to find it much more difficult to conceive. So making sure you put on a bit of weight if you need to, or lose that bit.
And how can being overweight prevent you from getting pregnant? Surely I can see how the underweight, you know, because obviously your body is not going to make a baby unless it has the energy levels to sustain that pregnancy. But in terms of being overweight, how does that affect
pregnancy? So we're not talking sort of a little bit overweight, we're talking obese or morbidly obese, when actually the weight itself is having quite a significant impact on your hormones. And your sugar levels and your insulin and your female hormones as well. So not everyone that's overweight is not going to carry a baby, of course not. But if you look at the studies, often a cause of subfertility is being obese.
And does that count for the men as well?
Yes, it does.
Yes, it does.
And actually, other lifestyle factors such as smoking and drinking count quite significantly for the men as well. So obviously, most women who are trying to conceive will be cutting back on alcohol or cutting out alcohol altogether and stopping smoking and any recreational drug use. But it is as important for men. So men trying to conceive are advised to keep their alcohol intake to less than 14 units a week. So that's kind of half pints or small glasses of wine, but not as a binge. You know, it's binging that is actually not good for conception.
So it's potentially not a bad idea, you know, if as a couple you think, you know, we've been trying or sort of not trying for a bit. Now we do kind of want a baby, actually just to do a bit of a health drive together and think a bit more carefully about eating healthily, about doing things that don't stress you out. Because, you know, there are obviously some stresses that you can't control. You know, if your work is stressful, then that is quite difficult. But actually stressing about whether or not you're pregnant is something you can control. And, you know, even doing something like, you know, mindfulness or, you know, there are some apps, just giving yourself a bit of sort of time to let your brain process and cope with the fact that you might not be getting pregnant. And maybe also just being mindful amongst, you know, your friends who are pregnant, maybe being around them a lot with their children is not helping you. So maybe, You choose to hang out with other friends.
Yeah, I think that, and as I said before, stress definitely plays a major role, and actually taking a break from it all, not thinking about getting pregnant, is often the best thing you can do. A lot of my patients have got pregnant when they've gone on that holiday that they've thought, well, we're just going to stop trying and see what happens. And then they get, you know, they will get pregnant.
And there's a lot of evidence, actually. I mean, I've had so many bump class girls, you know, through the years who have had years of trying to get pregnant unsuccessfully and then have sort of given up. And, you know, one girl I was talking to the other day, she said, oh, I got a dog and that dog was going to be, you know, a replacement for this baby we so wanted. And as soon as the dog was there, they got pregnant. And, you know, another girl had sort of decided that they were going to foster because she hadn't got pregnant after so many years of trying, and it just happened. And it just shows that eliminating one stress and sort of getting your head round the fact that maybe things aren't going to go as planned is sort of beneficial.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, you know, when you're trying for a baby before you've gone down the route of getting any help, it's important just to have a bit of an idea about how your body's working, what your menstrual cycle's like, roughly, you know, when you ovulate in your cycle, how your body changes, and becoming a bit more sort of body aware in that sense. And that, I think, can really help.
Well, so sort of noting down your periods, how long they last for, how regular they are.
Absolutely, yeah. So, you know, most, the average cycle is 28 days, but women are different. Some have shorter cycles, some have longer cycles. But as long as they are regular, which they should be, then you can take notes of certain things like your, like, well, for, you can even take a note of your sort of body temperature throughout the cycle, your cervical discharge, which changes around the time you ovulate, looking at, like you said, the length of the cycle, and all those things together can give you a bit more of an idea as to when you're ovulating. So I suppose, just to go back, your period begins on your menstrual cycle begins on day one of your period and ends the day before your next period arrives. Okay, so if when you first start bleeding is day one and you have a 28-day cycle, it's usually halfway through that cycle, about day 14, that you ovulate. And it's around that time that you can get pregnant, because an egg will live for roughly 12 to 24 hours. But that doesn't mean you just have a window of 12 to 24 hours, because the sperm can live in the body for 7 days. So you could have had sex before you ovulate and get pregnant when you ovulate. So you've got a bigger window to be timing your conception.
But you obviously can't have sex after you've ovulated, because,
well, 24 hours you can. Yeah. 24 hours you can. Yeah, exactly.
So do you think those ovulation kits are a good idea? I mean, you get loads of apps now, ovulation kits.
There's so much you get now that you can use to monitor. So yes, the ovulation kits, where you urinate on a stick and it tells you your different hormone levels and roughly when you're ovulating, and the apps that track your body temperature. So the body temperature, if you're tracking your body temperature, it will rise by 0.2 degrees roughly after you've ovulated, and your cervical discharge will become more sort of egg like raw egg white, that sort of thing, at about the time of ovulation. The trouble with all that is that it can become quite stressful, and certainly the ovulation kits, I've generally found them to be more of a hindrance than a help for most people, because you become so obsessed by them and everything revolves around your ovulation. And actually what's important is that you're having a relaxed lifestyle and you're aware of when you're ovulating, but it's not all revolving around that.
And I think, you know, then going back to the having sex, you know, you're then sort of furiously, you know, being forced to have sex during this window, and it sort of takes the joy out of it. And actually, it's one of the greatest, you know, joys in life, and kind of quite lovely that it starts new life. So
yeah, well, I think once you start actively trying to conceive, you know, and you start getting worried about it, it can take a lot of the romance away, which I don't think does much for stress levels and probably therefore fertility levels, which is why I think the recommendation, or the studies have all shown, that actually having sex every 2 to 3 days throughout the month rather than desperately masses of times over the ovulation period is much more effective.
In terms of age, obviously there's a lot about age in the papers and how maternal age is increasing, but also how in the public eye people aren't talking enough to girls about how, you know, their fertility does drop off. You get told as a girl, don't get pregnant, you know, your life will change. But actually how a lot of women sort of don't think about their fertility until they're maybe in their mid-30s, and then someone tells them that, you know, that boat has sailed. Mm. How old is too old when it comes to fertility?
Well, I don't think there's a simple answer to that, because it will depend woman on woman. But if you look at the data, women's fertility will start to decrease after the age of 30. Well, it will start to decrease significantly after the age of 36. It starts decreasing already in our early 20s. But
we're at our most fertile around like 16, 17. In our teenage years, yeah, 17.
Absolutely. And as a species, we're designed to be having babies then. You know, if you look at births as well, teenage births generally much more straightforward. I'm not advocating teenage births, just looking at how our bodies function and are most able to function with pregnancy, birth, conception.
And interestingly, we're one of the only species that lives beyond our childbearing years.
Yeah.
There's very few other, I mean, I don't think there are any animals that live significantly beyond their childbearing years. But humans are obviously living for much longer.
Yeah. And I think if you look at the if you look at the studies into fertility, it's sort of mid 30s onwards. But you know, there are many people in their sort of 40s, early 40s who have conceived naturally. The other thing to remember, of course, is that it is egg age we're talking about, not necessarily the mother's age. So if you have eggs that have been frozen or donated that are younger, then it's that's determining the fertility rather than the age of the woman carrying it.
And is it worth potentially girls, you know, in their 20s having fertility tests, or do you sort of think...
No, a fertility test in your 20s is not going to tell you anything about when... Well, it's unlikely to tell you anything about your fertility further on, later on in life. I mean, more and more people are asking these days about egg freezing if they're not in a situation to have a child in their 30s, 40s. And that is something that it is becoming possible for women to do now, is to freeze their eggs before they're no longer effective.
And how likely is a frozen egg to result in a live child? I mean, is it a sort of guarantee, or
no,
is it?
It's absolutely not a guarantee. And it also very much depends on when that egg is frozen. If it's collected and frozen in your 20s, or early 20s preferably, it's much more likely to succeed than if it's in your early 30s. And it's probably not worth doing it in your late 30s or early 40s.
And I suppose it's also worth pointing out that collecting an egg to freeze isn't just a sort of additional thing that your gynecologist can do at your smear test. It's a
big procedure. It's a general anaesthetic. It's inducing ovulation by injecting hormones into yourself in the preparation for it.
It's basically IVF, isn't it?
The first stage of IVF, yeah.
So it's a sort of month of pretty miserable injections and...
It is. It's not a small thing. Absolutely. It's quite invasive. It can make you feel quite bad with all the hormones you're having to inject. But that's a decision you have to make if that's the route you're choosing to go down. It's very different from giving a sperm donor, you know, storing sperm.
Yeah,
that's a relatively simple procedure.
And one question I've always never quite had the answer to: do you actually release eggs every month? Does a fertile woman who sort of has no problems, does she always release an egg a month?
Not always, but most healthy women with a regular cycle and no pathology will release an egg every month. But it's quite common for a woman not to ovulate in a particular month, particularly if she's been ill or particularly stressed or traveling a lot, or there's any issues with polycystic ovaries or any other gynecological sort of pathology.
And as a woman gets older, does that egg release become a bit more haphazard?
Yeah, it does. So yeah, the younger you are, the more likely you are to release. And that's one of the treatments for subfertility, is giving you a medication that will enable you to release an egg every month. And we'll talk about treatments in a bit, I'm sure.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Obviously, sort of, if people are listening to this, not getting pregnant, really the first sort of stage is to really try, think about your lifestyle, think about your stress levels, and make sure you're having enough sex. Try not to obsess about the ovulation. And then the second stage is presumably to go and get checked out as a couple.
Absolutely. And I think the important thing is to do that as a couple. And the first step would be to go to your doctor, who will do the sort of initial basic tests. So that will include sperm tests for the male, for the man in the relationship, and blood tests, and a scan is normally the basic test for a woman. So that will look at whether or not she's ovulated that month. It's done at a certain time every month. It might look at her ovarian reserve. There's a test you can do to look for, to look at, that gives a marker of your ovarian reserve, roughly the quantity of eggs left. And
I can tell by your face it's not that accurate a test. It's not like 7,824.
No, and it's not a number. No, it's not a number that is telling you the number of eggs left. It is a representation of whether it's it's normal for your age or perhaps under for your age. So it's can be reassuring, but as I said earlier, your fertility doesn't gradually decline, it sort of drops off. So it could be great and reassuring when you have the blood test, but actually 2 months later it could be in your boots, so that's not it's not that accurate, but it's a test they might well do. And also with the blood test, they'll want to take a test on certain days of your cycle, so just, I suppose, useful to know, most of those tests and scans are usually done right at the beginning of the cycle, sort of around day 2 or 3, and another one then towards the end at about day 21, when they'd want to do that. So if you're timing visits to doctors for blood tests, if you can do it around those times, you might be killing two birds with one stone.
So that's just checking out if there are any problems. What's the next step up? I mean, you know, we hear a lot about IVF in the media, but that's not the only solution, is it?
Yeah, I mean, actually, the other test that they'll do in the GP will be STI checks, because that's one of the very common causes of infertility is
sexually transmitted
infection for the man and the woman. So, but then you'd be referred to a specialist, and they would do some further tests, so possibly more blood tests, more scans, but they might also do a sort of dye test where they put some dyes into your fallopian tubes and take x-ray pictures of them and see if there's any blockages of the tubes. And they may even do what's called a laparoscopy, which is a little operation using a keyhole through the abdomen, where they can look with a camera at your ovaries and your tubes and your uterus and see if there's anything that they can see that's wrong there. And they can potentially treat some things that they might see are wrong at the time.
And for a lot of couples, these tests bring up that everything's fine, but you absolutely know, you've still been trying for a year and a half and nothing's happened.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's a large proportion of causes of infertility, it's not causes, is unexplained infertility, and you know, that's about 20% of couples. It's just never explained, and that can be particularly frustrating and, you know, difficult to deal with, I think.
And so can they help you in that situation if it is unexplained fertility? Can they sort of try and sort of boost more releases of eggs, or is...
Yeah, so then if they find a cause, it's often the easiest, because they can try and treat the cause and then your fertility will hopefully return. But if you can't find a cause or the cause isn't treatable, then they...
Like low egg reserves or like bad quality of eggs, something like that.
Well, or completely scarred fallopian tubes that are never going to become unblocked, or that sort of thing. So then they will offer you different treatments depending on what it is that the problem is. So medication was the first thing they'd sort of look at, and like you said before, that is medication that you get, which sort of encourages your monthly releasing of an egg, that's, you might have, a medication called Clomid or Clomiphene that people often have, and that's if you're not regularly ovulating, that is really helpful. But there are lots of other types of medications, hormone medications or metformin, tamoxifen, things like that are used in different circumstances. That would be discussed with your doctor.
And then, so then the next stage up would be IVF?
Then they might do surgery. So sometimes, I talked about the laparoscopy where they do keyhole surgery, and they're looking with a camera. Sometimes they'll offer that as a treatment as well, to especially if there's any history of sexually transmitted infections and possibly scarring within the pelvic, or you've had other surgery in the pelvis before, and they can sort of clear some of the scar tissue, and that itself can be a treatment. And then they'd go for assisted conception, but again, that's not straight for IVF. There's something called IUI, or sometimes called artificial insemination. IUI stands for intrauterine insemination. So that's basically
turkey baster.
It's not quite a turkey baster, but it's putting it through the cervix. So it's getting the sperm sample, it's cleaning, washing it, and selecting the best sperm, and then using a pipette. And this is done just like a smear test is done, no general anaesthetic. Using a pipette to go through the cervix, like having a coil put in, basically, and then they just place the sperm, the cleaned and selected sperm, straight into the uterus. And for a lot of women that works.
And then if that doesn't work, what's next?
So then the step up from that would be IVF. So IUI is just sort of natural conception, I suppose, but helping it along
in a controlled environment.
But the fertilization is happening in the body. IVF, you're taking that fertilization outside the body. So with IVF, you're collecting the egg from the woman, taking it out of the body, fertilizing it in the laboratory, selecting the embryo, and putting the embryo back in the uterus. And that's much more complicated and quite a lot more invasive for the woman who's undergoing IVF.
And that process also takes a long time. Just talk me basically through that process. It starts with sort of stimulating the eggs,
first they give you medication that suppresses your own sort of normal cycle. And then they give you different medication that sort of boosts your egg supply or stimulates your eggs, because they want to collect as many eggs as possible. But they have to do that in quite a controlled way, because you don't want to stimulate your ovaries so much that you can get ill from that. So they give you just enough to produce hopefully lots of eggs. Then they have to monitor you quite regularly, so they'll be doing lots of ultrasound scans to look at how those eggs are developing, and working out when the right time is to collect them. And those are transvaginal ultrasound scans. People don't often know that. That's using a probe through the vagina to look at the ovaries. It's where how you get the best views of the ovaries.
So not the jelly on the tummy.
Jelly on the tummy thing. Exactly, jelly on the probe through the vagina. Into the vagina. And then the next stage will be collecting the eggs when the scan is showing it's the right time to collect them. And that is a general anaesthetic, a light general anaesthetic, not for very long, but still you're under general. And then they go through and using a little needle into the ovaries, they collect the eggs that have.
And that doesn't harm the ovaries themselves?
No, that doesn't harm the ovaries.
And how many eggs do they collect? Is it one or two? Or?
Well, it depends how many the woman's produced. It can be quite a lot. It can be 10, 15. It can be one or two or none. And then when they've got the eggs, they will take in the laboratory, they will fertilize them, and then they'll have to watch the embryo if it succeeds through the different stages of early development. And at a certain stage in embryo development, they will do the embryo transfer.
Do they fertilize, use it one sperm, or do they just chuck a load of sperm in the egg and see what happens?
Yeah. One sperm. So. I'm not an IVF laboratory scientist, so as far as I'm aware, it's just one sperm. And then they watch them grow, and then they implant the embryo back into the uterus, and that's called embryo transfer. And they'll usually put one, sometimes two embryos back in, and you will have discussed that with them before.
And I think in the UK, you can't put any more than two. Is that right?
Yes. Yes, in different countries they will sometimes put more in, but obviously multiple pregnancies, especially in older women who are often the patients at this stage, it's quite dangerous. But then, of course, you know, yeah, and yes, you're pregnant in inverted commas because they've put an embryo inside you, but you know, there's no guarantee that embryo is going to be taken up by your body, and you can't test for that usually for two weeks late after the embryo transfer. So that's a bit of a waiting game as well, and very often. And it's absolutely not guaranteed. People often say to me, if I have IVF, does that mean I'll definitely have a baby? And unfortunately not. And again, that does depend on age. So the older you are, the less likely IVF is to work, or the older your eggs are, the less likely is IVF to work. So if you look at the statistics, if you're less than 35, you've got a 30, 7% of IVF working, of being successful. By the time you get to 40, it's 15%, 43, it's 5%, and over 44, it's 1.9%. So, you know, that's 10 years between 35 and 45, your chances are going from 37% to 1.9%. So it's not, unfortunately, guaranteed. And it's amazing what can be done now. But it's not that straightforward.
And that's obviously then if those eggs are yours, because another option is presumably to have not your eggs. If you are older, or if your eggs are of not good quality, or you don't have that many of them, is to get a donor egg. So, so if you haven't been wise enough, or had the money, or even the foresight to freeze, and quite frankly, egg freezing wasn't really readily available 20 years ago when I was 20.
No, absolutely. I mean, the egg freezing process has changed quite a lot. Even the method they used for freezing it is different now. So it's much more successful now than it was even a few years ago, which is why it's being talked about more. But yes, no, most people haven't thought of that, by this stage.
So you've got the option of donor from someone else. Yeah. So you can have someone else's
egg. If the problem of the fertility has been either worked out as unexplained, or most likely to do with the egg, then yes, that is an option, to use a donor egg from either someone you know, or from a donor bank, either in this country or abroad. And then it's the egg itself. Also the age of the woman at the time of donation of that egg that would determine the likelihood of, you know, like I gave you those statistics now, if she's less than 35, then it's a high chance.
And are most egg donors, you know, for commercial purposes, tend to be pretty young?
Yeah, I think they have to be less than 35 in most countries, but a lot of them are younger than that.
Yeah. And do you get details about, you know, anything about the egg donor, like physical features or anything like that?
It depends where you do it. And I think most places give very brief details. I think height, eye color, hair color, and what country they're from.
Yeah.
But then in this country, again, with egg or sperm donation, I think since 2003, the law changed. I might be wrong on that, the date, but where it's no longer anonymous, and the child will always be able to find out the origin of the egg,
the identity
or sperm
of the person.
Yeah. Whereas abroad, in various European countries or other countries in the world, that's not the case. So some people choose to go abroad.
And you know, speaking to women who are in this situation, I think one of the sort of things that they have to get their head around, if they've got to this stage, is that if they have an egg donor, I think, you know, a lot of women feel a bit sad that they will bear no genetic, you know, they won't have any shared genetics with their child. Yeah. Because obviously, you know, if it's your partner's sperm that's being used, that will still be your partner's child, but it won't
be. Well, it will still be your child, because you're carrying the child. You know, it's a few cells before it's implanted into you, and you're growing and nurturing this embryo. So it depends on how, and turning into a baby. It depends on what your sort of views are on that. But I mean, there's some really interesting data coming out now in terms of what we call epigenetics. So we know that obviously your baby, as soon as the embryo is fertilized, the egg is fertilized and an embryo is formed, the baby has its own unique code, its own unique DNA. But we know that those genes in the DNA are being activated throughout the baby's life, and that life is starting as soon as they are an embryo. So what epigenetics is looking at the impact of the environment on that embryo throughout the pregnancy, and actually how the environment of the embryo, which is by the mother, can activate some of those genes. So I think that's absolutely fascinating, and I think it's also quite interesting for mothers who are mothers through egg donation. There's something quite reassuring about that.
So your baby's, your body, you know, if you had an egg donor, your baby still could share some of your characteristics, and that has been.
Yeah, I have a patient who has twins through egg donation, and she and both her children have identical birthmarks.
That's amazing.
Which, you know, shouldn't happen. I mean, that shouldn't be possible.
And because egg donation's only really just started happening, we're sort of at the forefront of this scientific revolution. So I suppose in a way we're only just beginning to understand the sort of intricacies of what is happening.
And
I mean, science always baffles us. It always throws us a bit of a curveball, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, we're enabling some amazing things to happen through fertility treatments, be that, you know, simple IUI or you know, egg donation. It's life-changing for lots of people. And it's incredible, really. I mean, of course, you know, we're talking about all this and there's so much possibility, but there is a quite significant cost implication. So in the NHS, for example, you're not eligible for IVF if you're over 43, or there might be lots of reasons why you have to pay for it yourself, and it's not cheap.
And it's a bit of a lottery, I think, as far as I've heard, you know, depending on where you live, what you're offered and what the parameters are.
Well, I think in this country, and I know lots of people all over the world might be listening to this, but in England, I think you still get two cycles of IVF on the NHS if you meet the criteria, which are that you've been trying for 2 years or you've had 12 unsuccessful artificial inseminations and you're under 43. That's the guidelines, and each local authority will actually make the final decisions as to how many they pay for, basically.
When it comes to egg donation, obviously, the maternal age has an impact in terms of pregnancies just in themselves are more complicated, not the conception part, but the pregnancy part is more complicated the older you are.
Yeah.
But theoretically, if it's a young egg that's being inserted into a woman's, I mean, what if she's gone through the menopause? What if she's had a sort of early menopause? Could she still potentially host?
Yeah, theoretically, yes. Theoretically, yes. So she'd a woman who just needs to have hormone treatment to prepare the body to be able to carry an embryo and obviously have lots of support throughout the pregnancy. So physically, and it is a much, much higher risk pregnancy. But in terms of the actual pregnancy, the actual embryo, it's the age of the egg that is.
So the uterus doesn't start to shrivel up and become.
It becomes more and more complicated the older you get. I mean, I certainly wouldn't advocate a postmenopausal woman acting as a surrogate, but theoretically it's possible.
And then that's the other option then, if you know, the problem is not necessarily conception, but actually being pregnant and staying pregnant and being able to, you know, if your uterus is the problem, the other option is to use a surrogate, which is where an embryo that might be your egg and your partner's sperm, or it might be a donor egg or donor sperm or both, is gestated in another woman's body.
Mm-hmm.
And so she facilitates the pregnancy with your baby.
Yeah, absolutely. So that is another option if for whatever reason a woman isn't able to carry a baby, and that could be because she had to have a hysterectomy aged 30 for a cancer of the uterus or something like that, and there simply is nowhere there to carry a baby, you could still have you could still use a surrogate to do that, or like you say, there's recurrent miscarriage, and or the woman simply can't hold a baby. That is an option. Again, that's you know, it's slightly more complicated, but there are options in this country and abroad for finding an appropriate surrogate. And again, an amazing thing that we can do now.
Yeah, and I think, you know, women often worry about, you know, if conception hasn't been as they imagined it, because none of us age 16 were imagining, you know, potential IVF or egg donation or surrogacy or any of the complications that I'd say a lot of our demographic are talking about now. You imagine you'll have sex and, you know, you'll be totally in love, and then suddenly you'll be pregnant and it will be as easy as pie. And very often it's not. But I think one thing I feel that as a mother I've realized is that however that baby arrives, it's your baby. And I honestly don't look at my children and feel that I love them so much because we share DNA. I love them because I know them really well and I love all their little quirks and personalities.
And you look at, you know, adoptive parents, they don't love their babies any less because they don't share DNA with them. They, you know, they're their children. And I think that bond you establish with a child happens however that child arrives scientifically.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Chiara, for coming and talk to us about this. I hope you guys have found this helpful. I know this is a conversation that is sometimes difficult to have with friends, and so we thought that it would be a good idea to have it on a podcast so that if you are starting to worry or are worrying, or even you're not worrying yet, but you just want to know the facts, I hope this has been helpful. Before you go, just one more request. Please do rate and review this podcast on iTunes or wherever you get it. We are overwhelmed with the amount of listeners we have had with The Parenthood, but we can never have too many. And if you found this helpful, please do spread the word amongst your friends as well. But in the meantime, thanks for listening. Goodbye.